Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Traction Pieces Podcast, episode 418. Thank you for tuning in, ladies and gentlemen. This week's guest is the amazing Katie Wicks. This was such a joy of a chat. I think I messaged Katie separately afterwards to say just how, just enjoyable it was, really. I know I say this every now and then, but you never know when it's a guest you've never met or never had any interaction with. Yeah, we really, it felt like chatting to an old friend. Katie's got a new book out called Delicacy, a memoir about cake and death. And any regular listeners of the Distraction Pieces podcast will know cake and death are two very much on the table subjects in any conversation in this podcast. So, all the more welcome in this episode. And we talk a little cake and we talk a little death, but we also talk a big chunk of Wales. We talk a little slice of Brett Goldstein. We talk a dollop of Stafflet's Flats, of Ladhood, which I'm a huge fan of. I've got Liam Williams on next week, who's the guy behind Ladhood as such. We talk this time with Alan Partridge. We talk Taskmaster. We talk a whole load of weird and wonderful things. So you're going to really enjoy this one. It's cracking. Before we get into it, we are, as ever, brought to you by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. Christmas is coming, and SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com is your place to get Christmas gifts for yourself or for your loved ones. I've got a proper weird new bit of merch coming. I've not done any new merch in a minute, but we've got some amazing stuff. If anyone, you or a friend, are a fan of my music, we've got the Distraction Pieces 10 Years White Vinyl, the 10-year anniversary double disc white vinyl. One of the discs I went up to the woods in Vancouver with my recording equipment and recorded a spoken word version of the album. So that's available. But also we've got all sorts of beanies, gloves, scarves, jumpers, hoodies, jackets, umbrellas, everything you could possibly want for this time of year. So, head to SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com for all that goodness. I'm also sure that over the Christmas period, we'll do a little a Patreon Zoom hangout at some point. We did one about a month ago now, or 2-3 weeks ago. And that's all patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. It's like $1 or $2 a month. And, if you just want to chip in and support the podcast, you can go there and do that. But I mean, let's start messing around and get into this wonderful episode with the glorious Katie Wicks. This is episode 418 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Katie Wicks. Right, I'll begin. I'm here today with Katie Wicks. How are you, Katie?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good, thank you. I've just got over like the big cold that was going round.
Yeah.
You know, the one that wasn't COVID, that was a lot like COVID because we've all been, you know, sheltering and aren't used to germs.
Never a cold that's had more pressure attached to it because COVID.
More pressure.
Generally, you'll be like, oh, it's a cold, whatever, whereas now you're like, honestly, it's a cold.
Yeah, exactly.
I swear it's a cold.
I had to get an Uber somewhere to get like pick up some medication, and this poor guy, I kept saying, I've been tested, as I coughed every like 10 minutes. It was really uncomfortable.
I was out yesterday, and it wasn't a crowded place. I'm still being more cautious than maybe I need to be, but something was just tickling the back of my throat, and my assumption, because of my face, is that it was a hair, that somehow a hair has got there, and it was just tickling me. And the amount of effort it was, I didn't want to over cough.
Yeah.
I was swigging water, but I could feel it still there, and I was like, oh, this is a nightmare, because, I know I've been cautious,
And when you try and stop yourself from coughing, it's so...
Yeah.
It's like your eyes start watering and you're kind of... It feels like your head is bulging, like your head's going to explode. Yeah. It's a really weird feeling.
It's impossible. Yeah. I try and convince myself a cough is a psychological thing rather than the clear physical thing that it is. Like, nope.
Yeah.
I think my way out of it.
I got a coughing attack at a funeral about a month ago.
Oh, no.
I mean, I left the building in the end. I had no choice, but it was... Yeah, it's just awful. I think it's like a weird tension where people are kind of pretending that that's fine, but it just isn't.
Yeah, no, it's odd. And then I get weirdly judgmental if people are coughing and they do think it's fine. Yeah. Because it's like, it's really not at the moment, guys. Let's try and...
Yeah.
There's a lot going on. Well, there's loads of things I want to talk to you about. We'll get onto it later, but you've been brilliant in, I think... four of my favourite things ever. So there's a lot that I'm excited to get into. But before all of that, because I know the nature of podcasts is that the longer they go on, the less people are listening.
Oh, no.
I want to get right at the start to talk about your book, Delicacy, a memoir about cake and death, which tells your story as such through 21 moments that all involve cake or have cake attached to them. How did this all come about? Because you were working on this long before the pandemic, right? I'm sure I remember hearing about it pre this.
Yeah,
obviously, at the moment, I'm getting pitched hundreds of comedians who've all had to stay home and write a book because of the pandemic. But yours was already kind of
it's
in the works.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Because I don't really think of myself as a comedian. And I don't know. I mean, I do comedy, but I feel like it's not... I'd hate to just do comedy. I'd sort of feel really, like, hemmed in and...
Yeah, of course.
I feel like once I... Well, yeah, sorry, I'll go back a bit. So, yeah, I've been working on it for about 3 years in total. And really, the first year was sort of, like, working out how to write a book and how to write. Because I didn't do an English degree, I felt really... Just like, you know, it was beyond my capabilities to write. And so I just started to read and read because also I didn't really know what my voice was and I didn't really have a clear sense of my own taste when it came to prose. And I was so kind of swayed by, I would just read, you know, stuff that was on like a long list for an award or something and think, oh, well, someone else has said that's good, so I'll read that. But I didn't have the sort of confidence. I wasn't very kind of discerning. So I spent about 6 months just reading and sort of teaching myself how to write. And it sort of changed my life. I just had this completely different relationship now with books and reading. And I became more, I mean, this sounds really embarrassing, but more interested in my own kind of thinking. And it was kind of it was less about, you know, outside and what was good, what was bad. It was like I spent 3 years, it was such a kind of privilege. It feels so weirdly intimate to sit down and spend 3 years just on your own with a computer, working out what your thoughts and feelings are and trying to create this piece of work. So for that's really changed me in some ways. And just the things I've read and the writers I've discovered has been like sort of more powerful than like times I've dabbled in, you know, self-help, say, or the more kind of therapeutic stuff. I didn't realize that actually like literature could do that for you. It could like change you and heal you and help you. So that's been really, really powerful. And then I actually had to start writing and work out what this book was. And
did you set yourself a deadline on the research part and the starting part? Because that is one that it's never ending really. You can never be too prepared, but it can also mean that you spend 10 years having a lovely time reading books and never get round to the part that started you on that path, I guess.
Yeah, I could easily spend 10 years writing a book. It's, it's such a nice stage when no one's seen it and it's just like... But the editor and everything, the publishers, they were really, really patient with me because the other thing, I forgot to say was... So when I started writing the book, it was going to be this quite light, twee thing. And then people started dying and then in my life and then like, you know, traumatic things started happening and my mental health was pretty bad at one point. So suddenly it just became a totally different book. So I kept having to email the publisher and be like, someone else has died. I'm really sorry. I'm going to need another, you know, wow, 8 weeks here, guys, to think about that. So they were really considerate. But maybe, I think they thought maybe, oh, well, whatever she comes back with, it will be juicy and, you know, it'll be better for it because she will have emotionally bled in this next section. And I sometimes got paranoid that they were like, oh, great, she's written about that.
I always remember having a moment when I was doing music, and I came from like a spoken word background and music. And I always remember having a bad breakup and being in a bad way at home. And just before I fell asleep, I felt so guilty, but it genuinely crossed my mind. I was like, I'm gonna write some good stuff off the back of this, though. Like, this is rubbish now, but you give this a couple of months, and obviously that's very different when death is involved. But still, I can understand your thought that editors may be going, this is very sad, but the book might just have got even better.
It was a relief to have something to write about, because that was complex and deep enough that I could, you know, have 21 chapters about it. Yeah, no, definitely. And I almost wrote those chapters first because I thought, okay, like, you know, my car accident, I'll have to write about, like, the big hitters, the big sad sort of headlines. And then the challenge was, well, first of all, I felt a little restricted by this kind of theme I'd given myself, because sometimes coming back to the theme of like sugar and cake and sweetness and stuff, like, sometimes it would be a bit of an albatross, and I think, oh shit, like, how am I supposed to crowbar a cake into this? And it would be tricky. And I had to manipulate a little bit sometimes, but that's fine. And yeah, there were times where I was really cursing the whole theme and thinking, why did I do that? Why couldn't I just sort of said, this is like some stories. But when I'd got stuck, I read a lot of female memoir, and then I would just read about someone's experience, and either it would trigger a memory of something similar that happened to me, and I'd think, oh my god, yes, I'd love to write about that. Or it was also a lot about permission to write about certain stuff, because I would sort of think, oh, that's too boring, or you know, no one's going to be interested in these really kind of small domestic experiences, or something that just felt really boring to someone else. Like, there's a chapter I think I write about my dolls or something from my childhood bedroom. And I just kind of think I had to read other writing to have the confidence to be like, yeah, I want to write about a doll I had when I was 13. Like, fuck it.
Well, that's what I was going to say as you were saying that. It's the confidence, isn't it? Because there's stuff that I've read that has blown me away because of how confident it is to not be juicy and to not be full of drama and this and that. But it's been my favourite parts of books. So I guess it's allowing yourself that and go, well, other people might have the faith or see me in a way that goes, right, they're perfectly comfortable to be reading this, rather than you looking at yourself and going, what am I going on about? Who wants to hear my views on this?
I really love, and some of the writers I love, it's like those small, like, intense detail about stuff is my favourite thing to write about. And I really love it when I read that another writing, like, just these small tragic details.
Murakami was the one for that with me. I read a couple of his books that just went off on such seemingly pointless tangents, and on some of them I'm waiting for the whole rest of the book for that to come back in and have a reason, and then it didn't, and that made me all the more happy. It was like, right, that was just a joyous moment away from what's happening here. And I love stuff like that.
Yeah, me too. In fact, there's a short story of his that I listened to not long ago, and it had like about 4 pages of like a description of someone driving, and it was so kind of mesmerizing. Yeah, I feel like it's a kind of commitment to it that I really respect, where I sort of think, okay, I trust that there's some reason that you're going into this much detail about something. It's that thing, isn't it, of slightly slow. It makes me feel like I'm slowing down and paying attention to something really small, and in a kind of self-helpy way. That's it's very like mindful and good for you to do that, isn't it? I guess, like, good for the soul.
Speaking of mindfulness and good for the soul, what was the different experiences, I guess, of writing about, you know, some heavy experiences from your past versus writing about some heavy experiences from like last week or a month ago as you were going through stuff at the time. Did it help to have pen and paper, or the proverbial pen and paper, to get through what you were experiencing at the time?
Yeah, it's weird because in some ways there were days where I was sort of worried that I was almost like prolonging the grief and prolonging the trauma somehow by going over and over it and writing it.
Yeah.
But also weirdly...
having to redraft your trauma. Yes,
exactly.
That's intense.
But then also the opposite.
Let's have another go at that. tragic
Not
thing that's really raw still.
But then also in a really grubby way, when I got to the editing stage, the opposite happened. That I was so like detached from that it was me. I felt like I was like just this sort of weird narrator character that happened to have my name and my life. And I was just seeing it as like, okay, is that the right word? And is that, does that sentence need to move around? Like, I was really detached from it by the end.
It can be beautiful how that can, you make something that could end up being damaging to you or anything else. You make it its own piece of art, and then it does. It has a different a position. I used to have it a lot with, again, when I was doing music, I would forget that half of these songs were really raw and personal at the time because they've become, here's how I need to perform it, here's what I want to get across with it. And you forget that it's stuff, almost forget that it's stuff, as you say, that happened to you rather than someone that happens to share your name or your memories.
And when people would ask me if it was difficult to write, I'd think, well, sort of partially for the reason I assume they mean, which is the content, but also because I really wanted it to, I just wanted the writing to be good, that I think that was equally as hard. Like the craft of it was as hard. Or I think it's also really vulnerable to sort of say, you know, I think this is good writing, have a look at this. Like that to me is as vulnerable as here's a story about something really shameful that happened to me. And when you put both together, it's like, what am I doing? I'm going to have a breakdown. This is terrifying. Show someone you're writing and it's about your life is just like, why? Why would you do that? It's horrible. It's really embarrassing to write a book.
Completely understand. What's your kind of writing and drafting process? I know from my experience on scripts in particular that the good ideas tend to come out in the first draft, but everything needs cleaning up and polishing. It's on the redrafts, it's every now and then it happens, but there's rarely a light bulb moment or a gem moment. It's more, right, in this big pile of shit, there's one really nice thing that I need to tidy everything up and get a nice little path to it. What's your kind of process in that world?
Yeah, I feel like the first draft is always like, you know, really over emotional and really out of control. And like every thought and feeling I ever had about X, Y, Z. And it all goes down like a big vomit. Listening to music helps as well. Like if I find a piece of music that matches the sort of emotion of it somehow. And I don't really, it kind of, anything that hasn't got lyrics, I find.
Yeah.
Otherwise that's like a whole other thing. But it will be like a big like purge, and then I'll sort of leave it, come back to it, and then it's kind of like, okay, that those kind of go together and those thoughts go together, or that's repeating itself, don't need that. And try and like work out what the whole thing is trying to say, I suppose. I also think like the thing that I found really useful is just having, like making friends with people that are smarter than me, who have read more books than me. And I have one friend in particular who's like a sort of bit of a mentor now, that I'll just show them stuff and their you know, their thoughts are always really amazing. Yeah. And because they know me well, they sort of know what I'm trying to probably say. And they'll just be able to sort of make me be more precise, which was the best note anyone ever gave me, because I used to sort of think, you know, if I read a poem or something, it wasn't about like getting it. It was just like, oh, okay, I think this poem kind of makes me feel like this. And this friend of mine, who I really, you know, respect and defer to, was sort of saying, no, like it should make sense though. Like it definitely should make sense. I was like, oh yeah, okay, yeah. All right. It's not enough for me to be like, oh, I had this vague feeling once. Like I should like pin it down exactly what it felt like and why and how. And that was really opened up a whole sort of door in my head of like, yeah, it's not about sounding kind of like dreamy and sort of a bit vague. I was like, it should be really like just precise and clear what you're trying to say, even if it's something as complicated as grief, which is like lots of emotions all at once. That was so, so helpful to try and just, and I guess it's weird because it does remind me of like having only previously written comedy. There is obviously something very similar there of like stripping it all away until the thing you're trying to say and get it really clean and like precise. So that's the process, I think, really, is like making it like as economical, but like a sort of punch.
Yeah. I'll always remember that these podcasts used to always tend to be like 90 minutes to 2 hours, and I wouldn't accept any under an hour, and we're going to get around an hour today. But I always remember the first time I got one that all they could give me was 40 minutes. It was someone I really wanted to talk to, so I accepted it, and I came out thinking, man, I could make all of them about 40 minutes and it'd be far more precise and it'd be less rambling. Yeah. Part of the beauty can be the rambliness, but I completely relate there that I came out more exhausted because I was so conscious of, right, no messing about, just let's get straight to this. Let's not pussyfoot around anything.
No, but it's kind of it's kind of heartbreaking to realise that, though, because it feels so nice to... It feels like more is more. When you're in the moment, it feels like, oh, this 2-hour conversation is amazing. We're going to have more choice. And I see what you're saying. Sometimes it's like, it's a bit like when people, I mean, I don't have kids, but it kind of reminds me of friends of mine once they had children and they sort of said, well, the weird thing happens with time is that because I have less time, I get more done because I'm more focused. And like, we were talking to Daisy, you know, she wrote that amazing show Back to Life.
Yes, Daisy Haggard.
Yeah, I remember, I think she was saying that like, it's more like if you have, you know, she'll have like a 40-minute window, so she just has to get something written and emailed off in that 40 minutes. And whereas I could easily be like, oh, you know, it's 2 o'clock and I'll start at 5 p.m. and I'll get something emailed at midnight. And it's like I have to spend the whole day gearing myself up. But I just thought that's actually, I don't know, there's just like a real life lesson there. That if you have no time, then you've just got to like write something.
I completely understand that. I once fluked a really successful trip to LA to have meetings and that on the acting front. And all I could spare was a week. And my agent had said in advance, like, look, you're probably not going to get many meetings in because you've got such a limited amount of time. You kind of need to come for a month, blah, blah, blah. And then by the time it came about, every day was full. And it was because we were having to say, look, he's only got this limited amount of time. And it made it. We had to fit everything in. If you're like, oh, Pip's in town for a month, they'll be like, oh, we'll try and get something in. But because it was that limited time, it was like every gap was was filled up. So there really is something in that. It makes me think as well as of before I started writing scripts. I guess it's a case of the right format for each individual project or thing. Because I always wanted to lean on the I'd read about Shane Meadows and read about it not being scripted and all this kind of thing, and that made me too lazy to write a script because in my head it was like, no, it's going to be all improvised and all that. It's like, is it improvised because of the project, or is it improvised because I can't be asked to sit down and write a script? And I realized that 90% of the time it was my own laziness going, it's an artistic choice, it's going to be it's going to be improvised. It's like, no, you're not Shane Meadows, so maybe plan it.
You want to be him. You want to be yourself. Yeah, it was like the book ended up being lots of tiny, you know, fragments, like little chapters. And that was because I realised my like attention span is like shot to shit. Right. So it was like accidental that it ended up. And also I think that I didn't want it to be a straightforward memoir that was like, I was born and then this happened to me and it's all sort of chronological. I think I would have just found that really boring to write. I sort of think it ended up being like almost how we, you know, closer to how we experience life of all these like strange little stories and scenes going around in your head. It kind of ended up feeling like I was looking through a kaleidoscope at life and just sort of going, oh, that's there and that's there. And you know, this weird,
yeah,
like lots of little shards. But I realised that, like, I'd love to, I have kind of fantasies about could I write a novel, and I just think the idea of just one story beginning to end really freaks me out. Like, I love kind of having these little chunks of, I just have to finish this page, and then I can, like, leave my laptop. Yeah, I think that kind of, to structure something so big kind of scares me.
Yeah, I can completely understand that. It's all a case of finding the small tasks within the bigger task, isn't it? Again, I know a lot of writers who talk about that all the time, that the idea of writing a novel is overwhelming. Yeah. Who gets up one morning and thinks, I'm going to write a novel? Yeah. Whereas if you think, I'm going to open my laptop and I'm going to write a couple of pages, then that's far more achievable. Or even just, I'm going to open my laptop, or I'm going to jot down a rough idea. You know, these smaller things then become...
Yeah, exactly.
Far more achievable. So, yeah. I mean, speaking of it being bite-sized pieces, pardon the pun, what made you come up with the cake, kind of connecting a cake to each memory and each story and each moment? How did that initially come about? I know, like, you said you almost regretted coming up with it in the end, but...
Well, yeah. Do you know, it's funny, like, I mean, it's sort of my fault because I've got it on the front cover, it's there, and there's the word cake and a picture of cake, but, like... I feel like, you know, so quickly it becomes about something else. And
of course. My,
in my mind, it was always like this bit of scaffolding that was just a way into stories about so many other things. But I do think I needed something to hold it all together. But yeah, like, I guess, like, as I've sort of been talking about it, which is a whole other crazy side of putting something out there. It's like, you know, there's the making it and then there's the talking about it. It's just been really bizarre because I feel so aware that, like, I'm not as good at talking as I am at, like, spending hours writing something and getting it perfect. Yep. It's like, I'm just going to then say something which is like a shit version of the book.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't...
Each interview is just read it. I spent a lot of time explaining it in the book. Don't make me explain
I
it now.
I spent so long choosing the right words. Because the first story I had, or the first kind of clear memory I had, was like about going to France with my mum and... it being quite a weird trip and me eating this cake and sort of feeling like I was high, like kind of feeling off my face on this like sugar rush. But more than that, like a feeling of, you know, like when people say they have their first drink, that kind of feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, that's the only thing I can equate it to, like really similar to friends of mine that talk about their addiction. So I remember quite young being like, oh, okay, this is going to be my thing. It's going to be food. So I always had that image in my head, and I suppose how I roughly was structuring it was that I sort of thought that that was the beginning of the problem, like the first cake. And then it sort of how it kind of, it worked for a bit, you know, did its job, and then it suddenly stopped working. And then it was like, oh, actually, this isn't how you deal with your emotions. And then the rest of the book was sort of like, not a kind of, you know, here's her manual of how to get better, but a kind of like hopeful way out of it again. So I sort of roughly had that as the story in my head. But also I think, yeah, so I started with it, and then I kind of thought, okay, well, maybe I'll keep going, because actually the second story kind of has a cake there, and maybe I can do this every one. So it just unfolded like that. And yeah, like I said, sometimes I just thought, well, this has got nothing to do with cake, but that's fine, whatever.
I still want to talk about this.
Yeah.
Just because there isn't a cake involved, it doesn't make it any less.
Yeah, and it's
worthy.
It's really weird to me, like the things I was attracted to write about. I don't know why. Just certain things, I just go, oh yeah, yeah. I think I've got things to say about that. And like weirdly, there's so little to do with like TV and all of that side of my life. Just felt like almost the least interesting, I think, to write about.
Yeah, I've always been a big advocate of the fact that the way I think of it is, in the happy and exciting moments, we do everything we can to stay there and be there and take it all in. And in the heavy and dark moments, we do everything we can to get away from there and into a better place, understandably. But it means they're the far more interesting for me as a writer as well to explore, to look back at. Because it's like, right, that was an intense moment where I wasn't really looking around and taking everything in. I was probably absorbing it all, but I certainly wasn't thinking, make the most of this. Yeah. Like, you might be on an amazing acting gig and you'll be thinking at some point, oh, you know, this will be over at some point. I need to make sure I enjoy every moment and take it all in. You don't have that with the dark times. So I think it was, for me, it's why I've always been more fascinated by those heavier areas, to go, right, what was going on there and what were the emotions that I kind of, I fast-forwarded through to try and get to the point of happy on the screen.
Yeah, sometimes it's only once you're through them as well that you think, oh, okay, I learned something, or I feel different. And yeah, I really struggle to write about joy, and I don't quite know why. I think there's almost something a bit vulnerable about it. Like, I find it much easier to sort of say, there's something more vulnerable in saying, oh, this is what I really care about and find joyful. Like, I don't know whether it's almost like I want to protect it because it is so special.
Yeah.
And I guess also it plays into the whole thing about writing about other people and how you do that, you know, like ethically, how you do that responsibly. And that was tricky as well, you know, and partly because obviously I'm writing about people that are dead. So I sort of think, oh, great, I can do what I want. but there were times where I felt really guilty, and there were so many things, particularly with my parents, who are both dead now, and that's partly what the book's about. Spoiler alert, that's what happened in the book. But I suppose there were so many bits I took in and out, you know, I just couldn't decide. And then I think there was one day that one of my dad's friends had texted me in that really like sweet way, the way like my friend's parents are sort of trying to step in and be really, you know, sort of being like surrogate parents for me a bit. And yeah, I think it was one of my dad's friend texted me, said something like, oh, I've just seen something that you've written a book. And I suddenly thought, oh shit, like, I didn't think about that. I didn't think about
people are going to read it.
Friends of my friends reading it. And I suddenly felt terrible. And then I kind of thought, well, it's kind of I'm sort of entitled to just write about what I want to write. It is kind of my story.
Yeah.
So fuck it. But I did take stuff out because I just panicked. I just thought, I can't throw them under the bus completely. But I think it was quite a considered, like, they're flawed people doing their best.
Was the relationship with your editor important there, or the publishers in general, to kind of have those people who you can say, look, do you think I should leave this in, or is it okay to take this out? What do you think?
Yeah, they were really patient. The editor was great. He was a really lovely guy. And yeah, he was just so patient as I missed every deadline after deadline after deadline. He would just come around and we'd sort of joke about it, like, all right, see, speak in another month.
They must be so used to that. That must be such a common thing with writers.
I think so, especially like a whole book. It's like, yeah, it just seems impossible at the beginning that it's ever going to be there. And I feel like my body is so relieved it's over, because I just was like sort of this, like a sort of bent.
Yeah.
I sort of was like, and also like, it's, I'm so stupid because I have like a proper desk and I would try and write there, and suddenly I'd just be like on the sofa in a ball, like with my laptop on my chest, and I'm just terrible.
It's fascinating where's right to write, isn't it?
Really
mine
weird.
Has changed from in my garden to a bench near some water to in bed. Like, I had a point where I had my desk all set up and I was getting loads done because like I've got my desk. Yeah. And then I hit a wall. And the one day I decided to just write in bed.
Yeah, I love writing in bed.
I was back off at the races. Yeah. I was just like, right, I don't have to be at the desk and feeling all... Like, that helped in some moments. In some moments, that helped to be dressed and upright and feeling like a writer. But sometimes just bed, the curtains open a little bit, you know, but not much.
By water sounds
tiny
nice.
Tiny little bit of light and then just going, let's go,
Yeah, I'd love to write by water. Yeah, there was a point which sounds so, like, romantic, but... there was a point quite early on where I went to Venice for like 5 days or something. And
loads of water there. Perfect.
Loads of water. And it was kind of half holiday, but I went with another writer. So it was like half holiday, half like, you know, if we want to do something creative, we can, which was perfect. And I sort of got up every morning early and wrote at this like little rustic kitchen table. I had like the shutters open. Like it was like a washing line up with loads of like white vests. It was just like this real Italian cliche. And I got so much done. I think because I felt like a writer, I felt like I was in a film about someone that was writing a book. So I could sort of like play the part of someone who was writing, and it really helped. It was like an acting gig. It was like, oh, I'm a writer in Venice this week. And it was great. It really helped me to feel like it was real. You know, I really believed that I could write, and it was great. And that versus, sitting like in Peckham in a coffee shop is just not, it's just not the same.
I love it. I had such a similar experience of a week in Portugal where I'd gone there and the weather wasn't great, but I was like, I'm here to write anyway. So what does it matter? And as you say, it is, you're getting into that character of, I can imagine this scene in the film about this writer, about me writing this book. When this book has changed the world, this is, I can imagine this scene. But I think the other thing I realised that made a big difference was the only time I was watching TV or film, I was watching good stuff.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't in the UK where I can just put the TV on and have anything on to distract me. I was like, I'm going to watch this amazing French film I've heard about that I've brought the DVD along with me with, rather than I'll put Jeremy Vine on for a bit and get angry at someone's opinion. Yeah. It's like, what am I doing? I think that was a big difference. That just regardless of the country, being out of the country that I have access to, or out of my house, I guess, where I've access to so many of my chosen distractions.
It makes me realise how much I've missed travel, this conversation, and how environment is so... I think environment's probably really affects your creativity, doesn't it? It must do. Like sometimes, I think it's even just like just sitting in a different corner of the room. I sort of be like, oh, I'll sit here and try this and see if that changes anything and I can write differently. Yeah. But like writing in bed is, it's a real indulgence. I love it. Who was it? Was it Florence Nightingale that spent the whole last few years just writing letters in bed? I think it was. She had like a bed desk.
No, that sounds great. Good on her. Well, I mean, speaking of changing environments and environments influencing things, you grew up in Cardiff.
Just outside of Cardiff,
Only reason I bring all this up, I know it's so podcast to be, what was it like growing up and what was your route into acting that? But I fucking love Cardiff.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Wales. Cardiff and Wales were the first places I went to kind of outside of my local area. My brother, I went to uni in Lampeter.
Oh, really?
And we're 3 years apart. So it's just as I was learning, I'd learnt to drive. So they were my first trips to go in. We'd meet in Cardiff or in Lampeter. And that was, it's always held a special place for me. So how was that? And what was there kind of a window to say that one of your options is acting, writing, all these other things? What were your
We used to go on holiday in Lampeter. There was like, we used to go on caravan holidays. I really love it.
I love it there. It's such a small little villagey town.
I haven't even thought about that place in years. We were really little. It was really beautiful. So I grew up in like a, it was like a village about half an hour outside of Cardiff. There were like, I don't know, like three buses a day or something that would take you like, you know, into Cardiff city centre. It was so funny, like as a young teen, it was like, you know, going into the city just felt like this huge, magical, exciting thing. And it's so weird now to, when I'm, you know, I have so many friends that grew up in London, and that made me realise how it is quite unique and special place to grow up. Like somewhere that has like...
Or again, for anyone who's listening from America or anything, you say it felt magical. This city has literally got a castle. So that's pretty damn magical you're going into the city and there's a big castle in the middle
with like these weird animal gargoyles all around it.
It is magical. It's so funny. I can see why it would feel magical.
No, totally. It's like real, you know, like Merlin and Arthurland. And also I didn't even realise, I think like when I went to Stonehenge not long ago, on my one little trip in the middle of lockdown when we were like allowed out around the country finally, we went to Stonehenge because I'd just never seen it. It was so special. But anyway, my point is I didn't realise the stones came from Wales. I was really excited.
Oh, really? I didn't know that at all.
But Yeah, so like now when I look at it, I think it was quite, this village I grew up in, you know, it was quite eccentric. There were just really strange characters like you get in these, in like villages. Yeah. And I think it's, I don't know what it is. I think it's because I sort of decided that maybe, because it was quite rural, it was pretty much like the countryside. And I sort of think maybe because there's more space, people just sort of, there's more space to just become weirder and people just get on with it. And in a way that when you're packed in the city, it's a bit like if you suddenly start hoarding newspapers, your neighbour's going to go, what's the person like a number four doing?
Yeah.
But yeah.
You bump into less challenges.
Yes, exactly.
Your weirdness is challenged far less frequently. You can go a week without anyone going, why are you wearing those on your feet?
You could really go for it. So there's so many sort of people like that that were just real like eccentrics, and their house would just be as eccentric as them. These higgledy-piggledy houses that someone would like paint pink or something halfway up a hill. And I remember, this is quite a weird thing to say, but I remember that when I was about 13, it suddenly seemed like about 20 people died in one week in the village. Right. And I just remember being like, because I was quite a weird kid, I was into like really mystical things and anything that was supernatural. And I had been doing these spells in my room, and I became convinced that I'd killed everyone in my village by doing a spell. And I remember getting really upset about it and saying to my mum, like, I lit this purple candle in my room and I said this thing, and then suddenly all these people died.
I mean, this has got six-part Netflix series written all over it.
Yeah.
It's so perfect.
Yeah, you're right. It's very in witchcraft again. But
yeah.
So that's like the more romantic memory of it, in that it was like a weird place. And all those clichés about, you know, like, it's good for the sort of imagination, I think, when you're just sort of playing in a field and you've got like mud and a stick, and that's like, that's what you have to play with. Yeah. Not that we had toys, but
I think boredom can be a great inspirer. Yeah. I've the reason I've never left the small town in Essex I've always lived in is I think in London I'd be far too distracted.
Yeah, it is,
to get as much done as I get out here. It's the modern world, so I've still got plenty of distractions. Yeah. But still, I think being that bit away from stuff,
yeah, like before Xbox,
can be great for productivity.
Totally. Like my parents had gone to drama school in Birmingham, like in the '70s. That's where they'd met.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny because they kind of had their accents like trained out of them, because in those days it was this whole thing of like, well, you can't say Shakespeare. And you know, my dad was like from Pontypridd. You can't do it. Everyone had to sound like a newsreader. So it's quite sad in a way. So it's like me and my brother don't really, we kind of speak like them, because people are like, why don't you have like a sort of strong Welsh accent? I'm like, I don't know, because my parents sort of just
forced out of the family.
Yeah, so that was quite weird. And that made me feel a little different. Like, I think in school I really, until I went off to uni, I sounded a lot more Welsh.
I was going to say, was your parents, Daddy in the Midlands, what drew you to Warwick? Because again, it's that whole area. Was it just coincidence? It's where they accepted you.
Yeah, this is where I got in, I think.
And did your accent get stronger there? Because when I was at uni in Wolverhampton, I became far more Essex than I'd come home from uni, and people would be like, "Why are you talking like you're in Lockstock?" And I'd be like, "What are you talking about?" It's like, for some reason, as a defence mechanism.
Yeah, I mean,
I'd get far more Essex.
I remember the first week saying something. You know, can I borrow some toothpaste? And this girl was like, some what?
Excuse
and I was
me?
Like, toothpaste? And she was like, you mean toothpaste? And that was a bit embarrassing. But that's right. Because when I went off to uni, that was the first time I'd met people that were growing up in London. And one of my best friends in the world who like is from North London. And we met, we became best friends in that first week. And I just remember thinking like, God, everyone that grew up in London is, they've all like done every drug already. They've all like lost their virginity. They've all like got the coolest clothes. Like, they'd just done it all. They had like the best music taste. Like, I remember just being like, fucking hell, like, they seem 10 years older. And I felt really like shocked, and, you know, like such a naive little bumpkin is how I felt. So I remember finding that, but also realizing that the place I grew up, it kind of had its own sense of humor and weirdness and quite specific eccentricity, which I also now feel really grateful for. And when I was talking to Kiri Pritchard-McLean on her radio show about the book, who's from, I think she's from Anglesey, and she was saying, oh, you know, like, that there's so much stuff in the book that feels really well, like it has a really Welsh quality, and I don't know what that is, but it's like these like short little sad poems almost that we had to like study in Welsh language. And I don't know, I really liked it, like whatever that means. I was like, yeah, no, I see what you're saying, that there's some sort of sensibility there. If you've grown up in South Wales, which I imagine, like, I read, I think her name's Sarah Perry. She wrote The Essex Serpent and a book called Essex Girls. So I read one of them, and it was about like Essex girls, and it was like Essex girls from different times in history and stuff. But I guess she was saying a similar thing, like that there's quite a specific feel to where you're from, I guess, as well.
Yeah, completely. And it's always interesting because, again, before you came and met all these people from London, you would know the great nuances from your village to the village over, the weirdos in this village over there, or they're the real weird ones. And I always remember when The Only Way Is Essex blew up and thinking, that's not the Essex I know at all, because that's the wealthy part of Essex.
Right, okay, that's interesting.
The poorer parts of Essex, it's kind of like, right, no, that's not, it's not as, in many ways, it's not as nice as that, but it's certainly not as polished and shiny as that. But
yeah, I never knew that. It's funny, I don't really know it at all. Like, I don't have, like, reason to go there, do you know what I mean? Because I feel like if you've grown up outside of London, it's like I know South Wales and then I know zones, like, 1 to 4. And I don't really know much about what's in the middle because I just never have reason to go there.
Yeah.
So it's really fun. But I never knew that was like the posh part of Essex. But that makes sense. Yeah.
Or the wealthy part, at least. Well, I mean, before, or to kind of lead on to acting a bit, because I do want to nerd out over some of the shows you've done. Do you think growing up in Cardiff now would be very different on that front to when you did? Because there's so many studios and stuff have opened in Wales. Like, I've done 2 or 3 TV shows that are like, they've now built a whole studio just outside Cardiff or down even further south and things like that. It feels like so much.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Particularly from America, has moved there because it's got beautiful locations.
Yeah.
Wales and Ireland seem to be the two that American studios have gone. It looks medieval still. If you go, you drive 10 minutes out of a town and you've got a set. Like, we don't have to build the set. We can actually shoot in this rolling landscape.
It is exciting. Like, I got a few mates who like did design and set design and stuff at Royal Welsh College, and it's like they can just graduate and get employed, you know, not all of them will, but it's like, I know a few people that are, you know, building sets down there, and they've just gone straight into the employment, which I guess would have been unheard of, like 10 years ago, whatever.
Now Lord of the Rings and stuff are coming over here as well. It's going to be like the truck driver issue. There's not going to be enough set builders and techs. Yeah. We're going to have to open up more EU passports for people to come and build all
this
stuff.
That'd be my dream job. I'd love that.
Amazing, right?
Yeah, if the acting doesn't work out, I could quite easily just like build something, get my drill out. I made some flat pack furniture yesterday. Took me 2.5 hours, but I actually really enjoyed it.
But I reckon if you had an AD screaming in your ear, you could have done that in an hour. So
if I had someone dressed as a hobbit looming over me saying, I need this chair built now.
I need that now.
I like the idea that the set is all flat pack for
a
Hobbit's village.
Yeah, a little flat pack hobbit home. Hang on, I'll turn the instructions round. I've lost my Allen key. So what was your route into acting and stuff? Because looking on, like, Stafflet's Flats, Ladhood, This Time with Alan Partridge and Taskmaster are all some of my favourite things. But
they're the things I'm most proud of. That's a good list.
But I looked and Time Trumpet is at the start.
Oh, yeah.
And that's also one of my favourite things. Oh. And that looks like that was kind of a starting point. So,
it was amazing.
Yeah, how was that?
It's so funny. I've just remembered, without naming names, like, I remember really early on going to a meeting, production company, like a TV production company, and saying something. I'd just done Time Trumpet and saying something about it. Maybe I was trying to write something and I said something a bit like, and it could be like Time Trumpet. And I remember just this producer being like, oh, no, 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 no. No one watched it. No one watched it. I remember being like, oh, my God, is that how things are like rated?
Damn.
I remember being like heartbroken. And I came out of the meeting and I thought, oh, my God, like, I'm so naive. I thought they'd be like, wow, like we made Time Trumpet. But it was not, it wasn't a production company that made it, I should say. It was just this random guy who was like, no, 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 no one watched. As in, like, it wasn't a success. Nobody watched it.
Yeah.
And I thought,
I'm a big believer in the fact that the people that you want to work with down the line are the ones who will have watched are these things. I spoke to, can't think who it was, Australian guy. His name's completely gone from my head, but amazing actor. And he was saying that him and his mates were just thinking they're making these things that no one's going to watch. And then years down the line, every big meeting he's having in Hollywood is like, I loved you in this. And me and Brett Goldstein have always talked about this because he was always very much, just make the stuff you want to make.
Yeah.
And in the end, it will pay off. Yeah. And now he's off winning bloody Emmys and whatnot. And again, I think it's a prime example of that.
Yeah, totally.
The right people have seen it. It may not have been seen by 11 million people on a Saturday night, but the people who have watched it, probably the ones who are going to turn into something.
Yeah, definitely. I was at Warwick at the same time as Brett.
Oh, right.
So I've known him a long time. Yeah.
Amazing.
It's really funny. He was doing film. And so we sort of sometimes cross paths in the humanities block. We never had any actual, I don't think we had any lectures together, but it's really funny. Like we had some like friends in common and stuff like that. I know we hang out loads. I hope he doesn't listen to that and sort of say, you're forgetting all the times we have.
How dare you? I thought we had a moment.
I think we're probably at a lot of the same parties and stuff. But he was just like in a really cool gang of people. They were all a bit intimidating. And I remember he had like a black leather jacket and he was just like a cool guy. And I don't know if this is a horrible thing to say. Like I was a little bit like, that's just horrible, but he wasn't like clowny, he wasn't like funny like some people are.
Yeah,
he was quite serious, and I remember thinking, what, Brett's doing stand-up, really?
Yeah.
And then I saw him, I was like, oh, I get it, it's great.
I completely agree. Me and Brett have had far more serious conversations than funny ones in any
way. He was just a cool
guy.
I
also love the fact that his one of his favorite films ever is Grease 2, so the fact that he was a cool guy in a leather jacket is going to be heaven to him, because that, to me, I'm seeing him in Greece, just with a big quiff.
I remember that we were both, because I was doing quite a lot of plays and stuff, and I think maybe that's where we crossed paths. Because I actually do remember I was in a play, and he maybe came up to me afterwards and sort of said, "Oh, you know that you were really good in that play," and that's my main memory. So he was really sweet, and I remember that. And whenever I see him, well, for ages afterwards, actually, whenever I'd see him, he'd like, "Oh, you were in that play I saw. It was really good." Yeah, he's a sweet guy.
Thanks. Well, speaking of being intimidated by the cool kids, how was it to go on to This Time with Alan Partridge? Because pretty much everyone of our kind of age, particularly if you're into comedy or acting, has been influenced, has at uni, I'm sure were watching Alan Partridge constantly. I know when I only had 1 year at uni, I dropped out. I wasn't one of the cool kids.
What were you studying before you dropped out?
Photography and film.
Oh, right.
And I kind of went, right, the reality is all I'm here for is to borrow the kit that they've got that I wouldn't be able to afford at home. But I'm getting into tens of thousands of pounds worth of debt, and my working class mind couldn't balance that out. I was thinking, well, with film and photography, a piece of paper that says I'm good at it isn't as good as a portfolio that says I'm good at it. So it felt, why am I going to waste, in my mind, waste 3 years, get into debt that, again, from where I'm from, I may never pay off that debt if I don't end up doing really well, for a bit of paper that says he's good at photography, by the way, when I could just go off and do photography and go, here's what my photography is.
Yeah.
If you like it, cool. If not, you go ahead. So yeah, that was my thing. But I was watching Alan Partridge constantly at uni, on DVD, on video, on whatever else. So how was that to go and be part of?
Yeah, no, totally. Same. Yeah, like I remember the Knowing Me, Knowing You, the chat show I had on VHS. And me and my siblings just used to watch it over and over again. And I remember sort of thinking, oh, I want to be like Rebecca Front, like the way she sort of inhabits all these characters and stuff. And so I totally was raised on it. And then, it was nuts. It's funny, like, it's listening to Tim Key, you know, talk about it. And it's obviously more extreme for him that.
Yeah.
But I remember him, I remember seeing him loads when he first would go in, and he'd be kind of like white and sort of like, you know, we just like spent the day together. It was just like crazy. But yeah, like it was really, I sort of had to leave my body. Like it felt like I couldn't like handle it, but it was real. I remember, I was only there for a day, and, luckily Tim was in the scene with me, which I was really relieved about, just to have like, I could sort of look at him and be like, okay, that's like my anchor to reality.
Yeah. He's grounded it.
Yeah. Cause he's such a like good mate. But, so I remember like Steve came out, you know, dressed as Alan, and it was just like, oh, fucking hell. And even he had like, you know, his socks were like this disgusting, like salmon pink when he crossed his legs and it showed quite a lot of leg. And I remember, and these kind of loafers, I remember just thinking like, that is the perfect sock. That is the perfect shoe. It's all perfect. And then sort of acting with him, just these like micro expressions, which are just so funny that you kind of want to stop what you're doing and just watch, because it's just incredible. Yeah. And it was scary in that the two brothers that write it and directing it, you know, they're throwing lines at you. The script is changing moment by moment, and you sort of get, you're sort of told a new line like once, and then it was like acting Olympics that you have to just like immediately remember the line. And I mean, he's really lovely, but I felt this real pressure of like, you can't go wrong. You can't slip up. You can't, you know, you have to like be on it. And, but also because I've watched so much, I felt like I knew what to do. It was like a weird feeling of like, I kind of know when you're the straight person, you have to still like have something in your eye that says this is comedy, whilst being really, really naturalistic, but also just make sure that he's kind of always the funny one, but give enough like reaction so he's got something to like react off. So it feels like there's lots like going on. It's really nuanced. That's what I think anyway.
I was going to say it's allowing the nuance of the writing to do the comedy. And that's easy to say when you've not just been handed the line 2 minutes before you roll.
So but it was really,
you've got to just accept it.
And
all.
I remember there was a bit where he wanted to sort of change this line, and Alan was going to say something about that he'd just been to a supermarket or something. And there was like a maybe 20-minute discussion about what the funniest thing would be that Alan would buy in a supermarket. And it was so, it was like real like nerding out stuff.
Yeah.
Because someone would be like, apples? Is it apples? No, that's not funny. And then I remember thinking, oh, this is amazing. And but also being like, do I suggest something? No, like, you know. And I think one of the things he was going to buy was like white, was like, I don't know, I can't even remember. I don't think it made it in, but I think it was like white rolls.
Brilliant.
It was something really banal, but it was honestly like 20 minutes of like, what's he buying? Like maybe brioche, maybe that was the thing.
Yeah.
But I'm
instantly I'm thinking, and not in case he's listening, not to make a comparison, instantly I'm thinking of my dad a few weeks back asking if I could stop off on the way home and buy him a ciabatta loaf, which again just suddenly feels hilarious that that's all that's required, just one ciabatta.
I'm sure someone would have suggested ciabatta. That seems really, it's really partridge.
Perfectly, doesn't it? It's so specific.
Do you follow the accidental partridge? Really good. There's been some real crackers.
And they've quoted me a few times, or tagged me and stuff a few times. And I've kind of said, if I'm tweeting it, because Partridge has got into my humour so much, is it really accidental? Yeah. Like, that wasn't a serious tweet, but it was kind of. But yeah, it's that kind of. I've over psychoanalysed myself.
Congratulations that you made it.
It's a bit of both. I'd spin it as a celebration, and then
I hope it was.
Then be going home thinking, oh, was that?
I hope they were laughing with
Richard Madeley?
We're all Richard Richard Madeley deep down. Me and my friend were saying the other day, like, that we want to start a podcast where we read some of his novel out loud and then Richard Madeley talk about it. And I was, at the end of the chat, I was like, I'm totally serious. I don't know if my friend is, but I really want to do it. It's because, I mean, it's really mean and cruel to be rude about people's writing, whatever, but there's a really great radio interview where he was just reading some of it out, and it was very funny.
One of the bits that got retweeted by Accidental Partridge of Madeley was him saying about people being done for war crimes, but then saying, as far as I know, never charged the Hitler Youth.
Never
charged the Hitler Youth, whenever.
But also, I think he was saying it on, like, good, you know, one of those morning TV shows, wasn't he?
Yeah, Good Morning Britain. With, again, the fact he had a pen in hand just makes it all the funnier for some reason. Just a little.
Yeah. He said, he said something, he said, all my novels have like a sense of time. And I thought, like, how could you not have a sense of time? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, before I wrap things up, I need to talk a little bit about Stafflet's Flats, because I think it's absolute genius.
It's the dream job of my life.
It's got to be right. And it's such an ensemble piece. Obviously, and Natasha and Jamie's characters can be so extreme, but yourself, Al, Kiel, everyone are just... It all works so perfectly together. And I think the thing that I love is that it can be ludicrous, it can be over the top, but then it can have these really intimate and gentle moments as well. Like, genuinely, I couldn't see how it could become in any way nice, but when you and Jamie or Staff had your moments of romance, there were points where I was like, oh no, this is adorable. Like, for a brief moment, this is actually really lovely, and then not so much. And
it's like, I honestly think series three is the best, and it's out really soon. I think it's the 25th of October, but I honestly think it's the best. Like, it's really mad, this series. It's really gone into like a whole different place. But it is a dream, because like, we are all such good friends, and we all have like the same sense of humor. We make each other laugh, and that, I feel like that's the goal, really, like, is sort of trying to make each other laugh. And I don't think I've ever laughed so much on a job. It's just a sort of joy. And I think it's like, when we're together, we all kind of feel like we can really be ourselves and be like really weird. And it's like, it's like totally embraced. And, you know, sometimes I feel like in the past, I'm trying to keep it hidden. I'm trying to like say something normal when I'm like improvising and not say it. It feels like, you know, it's nothing's too kind of odd, because like, the way he kind of plays with language, I think, is so beautiful. And, you know, like, all the little words he gets wrong and the strange phrases he uses, like, I just love so much. And, but yeah, like, this series, more than ever, it was a lot looser, a lot of improvising. And I think we're a bit more confident in our characters and the relationships and stuff like that. And it's really lovely that he trusts us to kind of know what's funny about our characters, and to and it's amazing how we all seem to, when we're improvising, so there's just like, the chemistry's right, that no one like says this real kind of clangor. We're all like, why did Al say that in that scene? It just feels like everyone kind of pitches it right, like magic. I don't quite know how that happens. I think it's because we've spent so much time together, and we just kind of but also it feels a bit like pressure, because we really care, you know, we really care about it. And sometimes in jobs I can just sort of rein it in a bit and think, oh, that'll do. But it's like, we really care, and it makes it quite intense, you know, because I think we're all a little bit, we get really perfectionistic about it. And especially when you're improvising, you kind of think, oh, fuck, like, you know, like the day Julia Davis was there, and I'm just thinking, oh, my God, like, I have to improvise in front of her? Like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
This is hell. Yeah, it was terrifying, but good when it's done. The feeling afterwards is like one of like, oh, we've created something really special.
I love it. And it must be I can completely understand you're saying there, of the feeling of the pressure, because you care so much. Because equally, particularly Jamie and Natasha's characters are so ludicrous that I can completely see how you could end a day and go, was that Was that brilliant or was that absolute fucking nonsense? Have we just dicked about this? Have we made something beautiful?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
did we go too far?
Me and Ellie would always like get car home together quite often, and we'd sort of say like, surely that can't go on TV though, right? Like that bit where we were all like dancing.
Are they going to use that?
In the ring? Like what?
Yeah.
Like surely that bit. Yeah, it's so like the bits where we get carried away, you just think, hang on, like this surely to God, this won't be allowed. It's so strange.
I think the beauty is this is the characters that have been created. Again, similar to Partridge, it feels like you guys know the characters well enough that you can kind of take it anywhere. I've been on sets before where I've come home thinking, I've had the best fun, but I don't know if any of that will translate. Yeah. Like, we've laughed all day on set, but it feels like it might be a bit of an in-joke. Whereas you've found the characters so perfectly that even when it is kind of an in-joke, it translates because those characters are relatable and you can...
Yeah, definitely.
And I don't know, it gets across.
I've definitely been in situations when I was maybe a bit younger where... So if like, the director was really laughing at something, I'd, like, keep going, I'd keep doing it. And then afterwards I think, oh, but hang on, he had a really shit sense of humour, so why did I do that? Yeah. Like, really, like, people-pleasy, just like, well, I guess someone was laughing, so I just did it.
That felt lovely for me in the moment.
And then afterwards I think, hang on, that was terrible. They've got a terrible sense of humour. What have I done? So, it's tricky. It's tricky, like, to keep your sense of... some sort of integrity, I guess. I'm better at it now. Like, there was something recently, there was a line that I wasn't comfortable saying, and it's awful because in my there's this conversation in my head of like, well, you know, are they going to say, who do you think you are? Are they going to like roll their eyes? And then this other voice is like, yes, but like, it's you saying it permanently recorded forever. Like, you have to say something. But I still find it a bit stressful, definitely, to have to say, I'm really not comfortable saying that.
Yeah. I can completely see that. It's finding what's right in the moment. I had a big breakthrough on my own, like, a self-criticism of wanting to improvise a bit or throw things in and thinking, oh, is everyone going to be like, what the fuck are you doing? I then thought back on the sets I've been on. How often had had anyone said anything? And I'd thought, what? You kind of just go, oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, we've tried... something. It's the same with, as we were talking earlier, with the confidence of writing a book.
Definitely.
Is you don't generally read a book and go, who the fuck does this person think they are?
Yeah.
You go, oh, wow, this is great. This is an author.
Yeah.
And again, it's giving you yourself that role and respect.
Yeah, definitely.
In that realm as well, right?
Yeah. In fact, when I read something that almost seems quite arrogant, I kind of love it. Like, it's really refreshing. Yeah. I'm like, okay. Yeah,
completely.
That's what they think. Okay.
Bravo.
Yeah, I think, great, why not? Yeah, I've definitely, like, the first time I think I was on a set and I sort of saw someone really confidently just improvise and go off script, I remember thinking, like, oh, my God, I didn't know you could do that. But, yeah, it's taken me a while to... It's always tricky to judge it, to know if you're kind, if that's kind of allowed or not. It's all a bit...
Yeah.
It kind of depends, I think.
Yeah, the confidence to go... Do you mind if I play about on this one? Or just to do it, obviously.
Yeah, someone was telling me, an actor friend of mine, there was like a big, famous, sort of popular drama series, and like they've been in, and if they don't say it, if they don't literally say it and the full stop and like the and someone like stops and says no.
Yeah.
You know, really, I think that sounds quite, I don't know, tricky.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? But it's, again, it's the right... a situation for the right kind of writing, the right kind of performance, the right kind of drama. I know people, or easy example here. Again, I was going to start speaking about things I probably shouldn't speak about, but easy example is when I had Simon Pegg on, he spoke about when he was doing, when he'd written a Star Wars film and one of the actors was changing a bit of dialogue. He didn't know that dialogue was a reference. It was literally the line skipped to the end, which was Simon's little nod to Spaced.
I see.
And he was just saying, let's get on with it. Let's move on. And he had to kind of say, look, that's fine, but it's literally only there for a small... It's an Easter egg. It's nothing important, but if you can make it, skip to the end. So, it depends on the moment, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I've really, really embarrassed myself where I've improvised something And then it's like, it's shown how little I've like read the script.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I'm in like something a little bit and I think, oh, I kind of half read it, it's fine. And then I turn up and start riffing about being like somewhere. The wrong day it's set in or some shit like that.
No, you've read that completely wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, I did day on something once. It was set in like 1995 and I thought it was like modern day. I was so confused. I had no idea. Amazing. I was like riffing about my iPhone. Didn't make any sense. So you have to be careful.
This doesn't work in the slightest. Okay, yep, no problem.
You have to be careful.
I don't want to take up too much of your time, so I'm only going to ask one Taskmaster question.
Oh, yeah. No, I loved it.
Because it's just the best show. Yeah. It's got to be a dream gig. But you came in third place. Are you happy with how Catherine and Kerry fought your corner on the episodes that you had to miss?
Because so weird, yeah.
You didn't win either of those episodes, and potentially, if you'd got a win there, if you'd been there fighting your corner, Ed Gamble might not have been able to boast about this
it
for
was really,
a year or two since.
It was so surreal, yeah. So I missed two shows because I was ill. And obviously, like, it was serious enough that I had no choice. And,
yeah, of course.
I mean, I know what I'm being mysterious about. I had to have my gallbladder removed. So I had to have, like, major surgery. And But I remember being in the hospital, and I was almost, like, pulling the drip out of my arm, and I was trying to like make my way to the exit to get there, and then they were like, you
let me through.
We were saying to the nurses, like, I'm gonna be on TV tonight, and I think they thought I was like having a delusion. I was like, I've got to be on TV.
Imagine if they'd made you like a plush red bed to have in there, so you could have a little hospital bed at the end of the run of people.
If there'd been a live Zoom link up of me from my hospital bed. God, that would have been funny. So I was really...
5 points all round, surely, if you're literally from your bed.
I was so gutted not to be there. And I just thought, this has not happened in the whole history of the series. Like, everyone has managed to actually be there in the show. So
good reason, good valid reason.
Yeah, So when they said that that's what they were going to do, I was kind of like, oh, actually, that's cool. Like, those are two really lush women.
Yeah.
Like, it's both K's, you know, couldn't have asked for better. I didn't watch those eps for ages because I just thought it might be too weird.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of weird to hear yourself like, talked about like you're not in the room. It just,
I was going
like,
to say, oh, more the talking about you than anything
sort of
else.
God, what if someone says something really sort of horrible? Anyway, so I didn't watch it for a while. But yeah, I mean, it was great. I think they did an amazing job. And it was obviously very last minute. And but I know I was so gutted about that. And a friend of mine did say to me, I think they worked out the exact moment where I fucked it. And I think it was that I miscounted some ping pong balls. And they said, if I'd not done that, then I could have won. And when I realised that, I was so gutted because I didn't realise how much I cared. But it's funny because I really wanted to win. I just didn't demonstrate it. So when people sort of said to me, oh, you know, Ed and Rose were so competitive, what was that like? I was like, I was trying to win. Did you not see that? I was genuinely trying to win. So
that almost feels disrespectful on their part.
Yeah.
Like, no, that was me doing my best.
Yeah, I was like...
What do you mean I didn't care?
I was really, really trying to win. I was really considered and I really tried to do the best in everything. So, I mean, it would have been lush to win, but maybe it's quite cringe to win. Maybe you don't want to win.
It's better to be the only person ever to have had that stand-ins. That stands out. That's a unique thing, right?
Yeah, no, it's really...
I love it.
It was really weird feeling. And also, I got quite a lot of messages on Twitter being like, what's wrong with you? And so that just, it just seemed very dramatic. Also, because two were filmed in one day, it looked like I'd been that ill for...
Right, of course.
But it was just one day. I was in hospital for like one day, and it was the day that they recorded two. So I hope that's not giving too much away.
So that seems like you're in hospital for 2 weeks.
Yes, it seemed like I was dying. So that was weird. And then when I came back, I was on quite a strong painkillers, and I don't really remember that episode. I just remember like Joe Brand, bless her, as an ex-psychiatric nurse, being like, right, let me look at the tablets. Okay, take this one with food, you know, take this one every four, like, you know, she just sorted me out. And I remember saying to her, like, will you if I seem like I'm going to faint or something or throw up, will you like stop the show? And she was like, yeah. But they were very sweet. They had someone on standby. They were very like, are you sure? Are you sure?
Oh,
and I was
amazing.
Like, what can go wrong? It's telly. And all I have to do is sit in a chair and, yeah, you know, I can't digest solids yet, but that's fine.
And equally, like, you're not going to miss two more. People think you were in hospital for a full month. That's
just, I mean,
unbelievable.
It would have been quite weird if I just never came back. That would have been quite sad, wouldn't it?
You let me know how I did.
Yeah. Well, put it in the post. Just tweet me. Let me know what place I came.
Yeah.
At least I didn't come last, so...
No, you did great. Well, I mean, to wrap things up, as said, we've gone well over the hour.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, no, don't worry.
Book,
it was great. It went so quickly.
It did. It flew by. But what's ahead for you? Again, IMDb can be unreliable.
Oh,
I saw
a
short on there with Youssef, who I think is amazing, Hamsbury Book Club. But, yeah, what else is ahead?
Well, that was about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
No, I think... On Wikipedia and IMDb...
There's so many times I've brought things up that are on IMDb and the person's had to go, no, that project died. No, that stopped.
Yeah,
that's what happened. I'm like, sorry. Didn't mean
I stopped looking because it's so inaccurate. Like, my birth date's wrong on there. Like, there's so much of where I was born. So much stuff is wrong on the internet. But anyway, I've stopped caring. so staff starts, I'm pretty sure it's... If October the 25th is a Tuesday, that's when it starts. I just finished a series that Jack Rook has written. Do you know him?
I love
Jack.
Yeah,
he's lush, isn't he? He's so lovely.
I'm really excited about
he's
that
written
series.
A really lovely, sweet show. So I just finished that. And then I've written a script kind of based on the book, roughly.
Yeah.
That I'm just kind of chatting to people about now, which is looking, you know, it's got some interest. So we'll see. That would be a dream come true to you know, write something and get it made. And I'm just sort of thinking about what another book might be. Yeah. And then Ghosts. Am I allowed to say that? Oh, God, I'm always getting into trouble. I get into trouble all the time for like announcing things when they haven't been announced. That starts in January. So I've got a couple of months to just try and do some writing, I guess. So I should do that. Yeah. So, yeah, that's me, basically.
Find your writing spot. Try writing... Buy some water and let me know how it goes, because that became a big breakthrough for me. The problem became that all the water is about an hour away, so I'd be traveling an hour to get 10 minutes of writing done. They go, that's a good day's work.
It would be funny if I wrote like the world's first like sitcom set underwater, because I wrote it by the water, and we have to film it in a submarine or something.
Perfect.
Everyone like acting, swimming along.
Yeah. I'd love that. Everything having to be set in one of them pools where you have to pretend you're...
Can you imagine? That'd be so fun. That'd be so fun.
Well, there's some inspiration there. I'm sure that's on the cards.
Oh, dear.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was delightful. Thank you. They were really good questions, and thank you for asking them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
From the press stop.
Oh, yeah.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Katie Wicks. I told you it was a good one. What a lovely human. I really enjoyed her. As said, I'm a fan of her work anyway. The new series of Staff Let's Flats is so good. I've binged all of it. I've binged a lot. I should have mentioned that in the intro. It wasn't out when we recorded this, but since it's come out, I've binged the whole lot and absolutely adored it. The addition of Charlie Cooper, Curtin from this country is glorious. Everything about it was just, I love it. As I mentioned, Delicacy is Katie's new book, a memoir about cake and death. I recommend you get that ordered immediately. It tells her story through, as you heard, through 21 moments that involve cake and indeed death. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week with an equally amazing episode. I chatted with Liam Williams, and again, it was like catching up with a mate. It was, I love those conversations that are like that. And Liam is really one of them, as this one was. If you enjoyed this week, you will adore next week. So, yeah, this has been the Distraction Pieces podcast. I'll see you next week. Until then, go and buy some merch from the web store, because Christmas is coming and, you know, I need to buy carrots to leave for Rudolph. Yeah, and I'll see you next week. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.